I'm Gary Gerstle, Vanderbilt University Department of History, and today I have the opportunity to interview one of my colleagues, Devin Fergus, assistant professor of history who focuses on the 20th century and has just completed his first book, Liberalism, Black Power, and the Making of American Politics, 1965 to 1980, which is going to be published in April 2009. Devin, thank you for agreeing to talk about your book with me.
A pleasure. A pleasure.
And I look forward to our conversation. The first question I want to ask you is this. We seem to be in the middle of a resurgence of interest in the Black Power movement in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. Could you talk a little bit about why that resurgence is happening now? And secondly, what is the relationship of your book to that resurgence? In other words, in this new Black Power literature, what is the specific or most important contribution of your book?
Sure. Part of the resurgence has to do with the contestations people have of the 1960s and the culture wars of the 60s. And Black Power is considered to be very much an outgrowth of that. And you have a new generation of young scholars who are coming of age and are interested in studying notions of identity and race and class to some sense and studies of nationalism, especially in a sort of a post-Soviet age. And so I think this is the backdrop for the rise of interest in studies of nationalism more broadly, studies of Black Power in particular.
Does it also have something to do with a feeling that perhaps Martin Luther King and the so-called mainstream civil rights movement has been given too much credit for changes in the conditions of blacks and the struggle for racial equality? And is this part of a movement to question some of the orthodoxies about that and to rethink others who may have made contributions that are now in some respects ignored?
Sure, absolutely. And it's in part a counter-narrative to much of the King literature and scholarship and interest in King in a way to sort of broaden that argument. But in many ways, some of the recent scholarship, in particular, Peniel Joseph's book, right? Some of the recent scholarship is about the continuity between the Civil Rights period and the Black Power period, about deperiodizing Black Power. So very much so about asserting the agency of Black Americans in ways in which they consider Martin King and arguments about the Civil Rights Movement as sort of a deferential thing to larger issues of civil rights and nation. And so very much it's a counter-narrative in part to the King years and the arguments that King was the movement in and of itself, or as Stokely Carmichael would say, the Lord, because he was so embodied the movement. Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
So what is the most important contribution of your book to the rethinking of the civil rights movement and the struggle for racial equality and placing Black Power much more centrally in that story? What would you identify as the most important contribution of your book in that regard?
I would say first, I think the literature out there has been so influential in my own work and how I approach this period. And so my work in many ways builds upon the previous scholarship. But in particular, my own unique contribution to the very important literature out there is twofold. First is it says that Black Power did not develop in isolation. Black Power as a larger instrument of nationalism more broadly remained engaged and had this interplay with liberalism. And much of the literature sort of elides that subject matter. Much of the specialist literature on Black Power elides that subject matter. It's to reinsert Black Power into the broader narrative of American history. That's the broader aim of it, I have to say. And then by relocating that sort of sense, what does this tell us both about Black Power but also about liberalism more broadly? And that's the broader aim and objective of the book, relocating Black Power within a larger American narrative. And then by doing that, what does it tell us both about America as a whole, liberalism more specifically, as well as Black Power? So it's about reinserting Black Power within the narrative of the nation state in the United States, which I impart.
And once you reinsert Black Power into that major narrative, how do we see Black Power differently?
Sure. We see Black Power as an extension of civic nationalism in many ways. As an expression of civic nationalism in many ways. We see Black Power in its interplay, its intersectionality with liberalism more broadly. And Black Power is a more open movement than people have heretofore thought about it. And because Black Power is much more open than scholars and the general public have sort of looked at it and perceived it, that openness means that it could also be modified or co-opted. If it could be engaged, it could be modified or co-opted. And also in this sort of sense, and in some levels, this is a project which is at some levels been informed by the Iraq war. I mean, we see the complexity in Iraq of trying to build a nation state and that problem of what it – I mean, how difficult it is, the Byzantine world of nation building. The Byzantine world of nation building by the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, the United States. And so if nation building is a difficult project in a place like – space like Iraq, we can imagine what this project of institution building, nation building for these Black Power activists, how difficult that project was for them. And the practical questions they had to address in the efforts to build a nation, or at least to first to imagine a nation, and then to the practicality of building one. And so, in that sense, the things like efforts to build a nation, to rebuild a nation in Iraq, is at some levels sort of informed my project on Black Power.
So, do you view Black Power as less revolutionary than some others have written, or do you think that it? Certain points it was revolutionary, but at other points it made accommodations to liberalism.
Yes is the answer, Gary.
Okay.
All of the above. I mean, Black Power exists on a continuum, like in many ways like nationalism does. And so there were Black Power groups which were very revolutionary. The Black Panther Party, for instance, was considered to be a sort of revolutionary organization. And they were that group was modified in many ways, and there were Black Power organizations which were a bit more mild or moderate in their original political agenda. And a classic example might be something like Soul City, but wherever you would plot Black Power on the continuum from a modified agenda to a revolutionary one, wherever you plot it on the continuum, all of it engaged liberalism at some level. It existed and functioned in the context of this golden age of liberalism, which is basically 1930s through early 1970s. So, and that's the context in which we find Black Power located and existing.
Mm-hmm. And now, most of your book focuses on North Carolina, and consists of a series of very rich case studies of Black Power activities, struggles in North Carolina. Could you tell us first why you chose North Carolina as opposed to some other state? What drew you to that? And then also perhaps give an example or two of Black Power in action in North Carolina that would illustrate for us the way in which Black Power, as you suggested so well, operates along this continuum. But first tell us what drew you to North Carolina.
I could imagine the response if I had done a study of liberalism and Black Power in New York or San Francisco,
or Oakland,
exactly, in those sorts of spaces. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to look at Black Power in a space we might not first initially imagine it, North Carolina. So that's part of it. North Carolina existed it's known as a progressive Southern state, and it also existed as an epicenter for the Black Power movement. And so if I want to make the point that if we can illustrate or demonstrate the rise of institutional Black Power in a place like North Carolina. And I can't think operative word is institutional. I mean, Black Power was about nation building, so it challenges notions of Black Power as nihilistic, as about utter destruction. So, I mean, if to demonstrate the institutional rise of Black Power in North Carolina, we can demonstrate it there. The implication would be, of course, we can imagine it in more progressive spaces like in Oakland, like New York, like a Boston, like a Chicago. So if you can imagine Black Power in more conservative spaces like North Carolina, of course we can imagine it existing in other more progressive ones.
One of the really interesting chapters in your book are the two that focus – or two of the most interesting chapters are those that focus on Joanne Little, who is an inmate in a North Carolina penitentiary. And is raped by a guard and kills him and then escapes and is arrested and has a very celebrated trial and is acquitted for reasons of self-defense. Could you tell us a little bit about that case and also what that case illustrates for you about the fluidity of black power politics in North Carolina.
Sure. As you nicely summed, Joanne Little was a black woman who was incarcerated on the eve of her release. Her jailer comes into the cell, and he comes in twice. The first time he comes with a sandwich and soda, and the second time he comes in with an ice pick, ostensibly for sexual favors. And Little, I basically tell the story of how Little, as you well said, kills the jailer. That's without dispute. And then there's a debate whether she kills him for self-defense or whether she was trying to escape. Initially, she escapes the cell. She's indicted for capital murder. And in North Carolina in the 1970s, capital murder basically meant a death sentence. North Carolina had more people on death row in the 1970s than any other state in the U.S., and the only state in the union with women on death row. And so in that sense, in a very twisted way, North Carolina was expressing its gender equality. And I go about telling the story of how not simply was Joanne Little acquitted, but she was acquitted in little more than an hour, and that her acquittal is in large part a window into the world of liberalism in North Carolina, the efforts to be a cosmopolitan state, and the ways in which black power demonstrated its practicality, modifying its rhetoric to be more inviting and more open to not simply blacks, but to women as well, and to be inviting to people. As one of the spokesperson for Joanne Little said, one of the black nationalists would say, because he wanted Joanne Little to demonstrate that her story is a story of liberal universalism, of universalism. And as another supporter of Joanne Little said, that her story was a story of human fullness and human equality. So what the Little chapters illustrate is black power's openness to notions of liberal universalism and human equality. Not necessarily we can say whether they embraced it and deeply believed it. That's hard to determine. That's a bit murky. But the willingness to modify that language because they saw a higher goal, a higher aim. That higher goal was saving of Joanne Little's life and getting her off of death row. And so I go about telling that story. And also go about again, laying the complexity of these black power activists who on one level demonstrated their enlightenedness and their ability to modify their rhetoric. But at the same time, also were engaged in misogynistic behavior and sexual abuse of their own. And so I lay out the complexity of that in two chapters.
One of the stories you tell in a broader thematic way is that black power moderated itself in dialogue with liberalism. It got a fair amount of its money from liberal institutions of one sort or another. It understood that if it wanted to carry on with its positive nation-building programs, it needed to have activities, needed to have support, and for that they required support from beyond their own community, mm-hmm. and much of that came from white liberals. So one way of reading your book is that over time the engagement between liberalism and black nationalism moderated black nationalism. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you if that is a correct reading of your book, and if it is, I would then ask you to go on and to say something about the ways in which black nationalism may have influenced liberalism. How did black nationalism change liberalism, if at all, through the dialogue that those two movements had?
Sure. The relationship between black power and liberalism, how did black power change liberalism? What I'd probably say is, and I can give a sort of a long answer, but what I'd probably say is if there's one thing to take out of this interplay between liberalism and black power and what it tells us about liberalism is that what black power can show America, show the nation state at this particular point, the U.S. at this particular point, is the elasticity of liberalism. Liberalism is not a feckless ideology. And it showed how liberalism's ability to engage radical civic ideologies and bring those civic ideologies back from the brink of political violence. And so what this interplay of story tells us is how basically how liberalism succeeds and how it succeeded as a political philosophy, mm-hmm. A political philosophy in part designed to bring more radical civic ideologies back from the brink of violence and social nihilism. And so I think that's how black power can inform us about on liberalism.
Now, the moment of the rapprochement between liberalism and black power, which I think you would probably say happens in the 1970s as opposed to the late 1960s,
sure.
is also the moment when Jesse Helms rights to power in North Carolina politics. Mm-hmm. The story you tell about the rapprochement between black power and liberalism is a very positive story of two movements in tension but also working together and making for a better America, both for blacks and for America more generally. Of course, Jesse Helms thinks they're both destroying America, and it becomes his crusade, if he can, to wipe them both off the face of American politics. Mm-hmm. So what does the rise of Jesse Helms at this moment tell us about the liberalism black power project?
Sure. It tells us that the narrative of black power running amok over liberalism, the narrative of liberalism as being too effete ideology to control essentially more violent ones, more radical ones certainly, that narrative was quite powerful and quite persuasive to a majority of voters in North Carolina consistently and many voters across the nation. And so the rise of Helms illustrates – and I don't want to paint the picture too broad. What it does is it encapsulates that argument, the argument that Helms and others have about liberalism more broadly. In this context, it's liberalism, its relationship to black power in the U.S., but it's a larger argument and concern more so. And certainly in their view, a very legitimate concern about if we continue to go down this road and path of liberalism, what it might mean for national security in the nation state. The FISA courts were largely created in response to the rise of black power and the abuses in which the state used against black power, particularly the Black Panther Party. And so we still live with the consequences of state action in relationship to black power in the 1970s. And so we still live these issues today.
As our conversation has made clear, this book addresses some of the most important questions about politics and liberalism, conservatism, and radicalism in the second half of the 20th century. It's very rich both conceptually and empirically. And my final question then is there anything that you want to bring to the reader's attention that we haven't talked about, something important in your book, either an episode or a moment or a theme that will give readers an additional reason to look deeply into and explore your work?
Just more broadly, that I think it's important that we revisit and rethink both our understandings of liberalism and black power, and particularly in this day and age. In doing so, we'll have, I think, a better sense of what it means to be a nation, a civic nationalist country, quite frankly, and the values of civic nationalism. And so in rethinking liberalism and black power, I think we'll have a much richer understanding of what it is to be a nation under the rubric of civic nationalism.
Devin Fergus, thank you very much. Devin's book, again, is Liberalism, Black Power, and the Making of American Politics, 1965 to 1980. To be published by the University of Georgia Press in April 2009. For those of you listening to this podcast, it's a very, very good book, and I encourage each of you who's listening to this to take an opportunity to read in it and learn from it. Devin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary.